Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
I'm Lisa Stone, and you're listening to Parenting Aces. Welcome to Season 13 of the Parenting Aces podcast, a proud member of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and this week I am talking with an old friend of mine, an even older friend of my husband's, actually, Joel Drucker. You may recognize Joel's name, A, from the podcast, B, from my social media, C, from being an incredible tennis journalist who has written for some of the largest publications that there are. He's also a book author and has just done incredible work in our sport. I'm thrilled to have Joel back on the podcast to talk about a recent article that he wrote for tennisrecruiting.net. So before I bring Joel on, just a quick reminder, if you haven't already, we would love for you to become a premium member of Parenting Aces. Just go to our website, parentingaces.com, and click on the join button to see all of your options. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with my friend Joel Drucker.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Joel Drucker, it is so nice to see you on the other end of my Zoom call. We've run into each other periodically since I made the move back to SoCal. And before that, I mean, what a weird kindling of a friendship. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, very nice. Great to be with you here, Lisa. I know it's always fun to talk about tennis with you, a fellow tennis player, fellow left-hander, and figure out some ways to at least identify the world's problems.
Identify. I think we can do more than that. I think we can solve one or two here and there.
Maybe. Okay.
Yeah, we'll see. So the impetus behind this conversation is a recent article that you wrote, and you had contacted me about this article. I think I was actually on my way back to Louisiana when we talked, and told me that the article was coming out and thought that it might make some good conversation for Parenting Aces. And I agreed, and here we are. And the article was recently published on tennisrecruiting.net, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes on parentingaces.com. And in the article, you do a deep dive into a SoCal local junior who is showing some tremendous progress and promise and has great ambition and has a family supporting that. And so I thought we could just kind of dive a little deeper into all of that, how you decide that a junior player is somebody that you want to follow, and why, of all things, junior tennis for you, who has written for the biggest tennis publications in the world, what interests you about the juniors?
Well, why don't we start with that question, and then we'll back into the subject of a young woman named Eva Jovic, who's currently in Australia. And junior tennis, look, on the good days, I like to think that what I'm really writing about is development, is human development, and the evolution of someone's life at various stages, whether it's the young stage as a junior player, whether it's in the middle of the pro career, whether it's at the other end. I've written many stories and talked many times with people at the other end of their pro career. They finished being pros or their tennis life. I guess I'm kind of a natural biographer. I like profiling people. I like understanding people and their singularity about what makes them tick. And tennis is a great vehicle for that. I mean, I'm kind of a gregarious loner, and tennis is a good sport for people like that. It's a very self-contained sport. And so junior tennis is part of it. And look, stories, I would like to write a story one day about someone who maybe they got to the Nationals once and they're off to college and what tennis means to them. I mean, a lot of this is the subject of what editors think they're interested in too. I mean, if you're getting a marketplace and there's a publication, a general interest publication that I started to write this story for and then ended up working out better for tennisrecruiting.net. So a lot of it has to do with the mix of what the editors are interested in and the person willing to give me time. I'm Steve Pratt, a public relations person who we both know, very active in Southern California. He and I were talking. He said, you ought to check out this Eva. She's a very interesting player. I mean, she's done really well. She won the 18 junior sectionals when she was 13 in Southern California. She's done well at the Easter Bowl and the Orange Bowl. I mean, she's done a number of things. I think when I checked the other day, she's 11 in the ITF 18s rankings. So she's on a very fast track and dedicating herself to tennis, very much loves the game. So I explored with her family and one of her coaches, Peter Smith, to see if I could spend time with her. This was a few months ago. They said, yes, we'll give you some time. And this was more than just give me an hour and I'll write a quick story about what you love about the game and what makes you good. This was a more deeper look at her and her motivations and all of that.
Well, and that's one of the things I thought was so cool about this is one of the quotes from Peter Smith in the article has to do with Eva saying that she's going to be number one in the world. And when he heard her say that, his quote is something along the lines of, she didn't say it like most kids say it. She said it with a conviction that made him believe that he could help her actually achieve that goal. And I thought that was, I mean, most kids when they're, you know, 8, 9, 10, they're just starting in the sport, they want to be the next Serena or the next Federer or whoever. And these are their big dreams and their big goals. But Peter saw something different in Eva that made him, and let's face it, Peter Smith, former head men's coach at USC, let's just qualify, won 5 national championships while there. He's a pretty sought after coach. And so for him to dedicate time to working with a young junior, there must have been something there that he was seeing.
Oh, no. Well, see, she's a very driven, she's got a certain sense of determination about her, very much driving the tennis, very much wants to play, was playing a lot before the pandemic started. And then when the pandemic started playing even more. The pandemic created a lot of capacity opportunities for people. They were being de facto homeschooled anyway. They weren't in classrooms. And so her tennis took off even more. She won that 18 sectionals in 2021. But I think the point of this show and the point of the story is not to assess Eva's prospects and her potential, not to say 10 years from now, if she's number 3 in the world, are number 3,000, or not playing tennis, that therefore she's failed. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the thing I want to get at in these stories. And I was excited about this piece that I was able to address questions that most people don't address in these stories. What most people do in these stories, they look at it on two ways. There's the first one, and you and I were talking about it before, the speculators. How good is she? How good could she be? How good could she really be? What potential does she have to be great? And the typical quote sometime about 65-70% of the stories, she's working on her second serve, she's starting to volley more, she's adding more variety to her game, and look at this. Yes, she hit 3 swing volleys in her recent 16s win. And those are the speculators. And of course, that becomes the business of the game, and can she become the next American thing? And Americans, there's a term I read years ago in a book called The Lonely Crowd that says how Americans enjoy being inside dopesters. Americans enjoy saying, hey, I saw this kid. I knew him then. That's a big thing in America. We like feeling like we're on the knew it before. I saw this kid when he was 11 and knew it was going to be great. And this kind of predictive thing. So there's one hand, there's the speculators. Then there's the other angle, which is what I call the social workers. Oh, she's missing out on a normal childhood. She's not having the things, she's sacrificing. And I think that's kind of a form of, that's arguably silly too. I mean, I don't know what a normal childhood is. When someone tells me what one is, let me know. It's childhood by definition is not normal. Whether you're growing up with a certain amount of money or a certain amount of money, I don't know. Was my friend who had to work at McDonald's 15 hours a week, is that a normal childhood? Some people don't have to work in childhood. All these things, I don't know what normal is. So I think what I wanted to do was just take a look at her herself. I think the story, her parents were terrific, Bojan and Elena, and it's clear that Eve is the one really driving her tennis. If she wasn't, and if it was a family that wasn't things, that would have been a more harder story to write. Mm-hmm. That would have been a more difficult story to write, but it's so clear how much she enjoys the game and learning things and working with Peter and other coaches at the USTA. So it's really interesting to kind of dive into it. Traveling all over, very interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. I was at the SoCal tournament that she won back in
Reading?
Yeah. Oh, well, no, the one down in San Diego. She won an event down in San Diego when she was young too. Not the pro event, but the junior event. Okay. And several people came up to me and said, you need to go take a look at this girl. She's only 14 and she's beating all these 18-year-olds and da 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 da, and she's working with Peter Smith and blah 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 blah. And you're right, like everybody likes to be the one that is in on the new thing, right? And
that's very big in this country. I don't know what the country was. It's a very big American thing because we're so big on innovation and being ahead of the curve. And seeing things new. Look, I remember a few years ago, someone's telling me about some local tournament. They go, oh yeah, I want to see this 11-year-old who beat the number 3 seed. I go, there's always an 11-year-old who beat the number 3 seed. I mean, I saw Tracy Austin play when she was 10 years old. I talk about that in the story. 50 years, I saw Tracy Austin play at a park in Santa Monica. And so that's Tracy Austin. And then a couple of years later, she's on the cover of Sports Illustrated. That's great. All right. But I guess when we're looking at parenting aces, I think we have to kind of look at what's really going on here and what's this tennis experience really about? I mean, I guess that's the thing I want to figure out. I mean, that's the thing you address with your show. I mean, the point isn't like, I did not want to write a story to say, look, future number one. I think it's just that she's saying these things is great, but it doesn't mean she fails if she doesn't.
Right.
That mean like someone, I don't know. I think to me, another story that could be part of this is look at people at other stages. Well, how do we define success? How do we define winning? What it means to pursue and succeed because we're pursuing or succeed because we're attaining?
Yeah. Well, it's that whole thing of growth mindset versus fixed mindset, right? Are we focused on outcomes or are we focused on the process? And I have tried to be of the mindset that we need to focus on the process, that there's so many lessons that our sport offers to our children. And if we can stay focused on that, as opposed to rankings, ratings, wins and losses, trophies, all those things, scholarships, then we are better serving our children in their pathway from childhood to adulthood, right? We are providing opportunity for them to develop skills, to pursue opportunities, to experience new things that all hopefully will coalesce into a highly functioning adult member of society somewhere down the road.
Who enjoys tennis?
Who enjoys tennis, by the way?
Who can enjoy this lifelong sport? But it's a really tricky thing. I mean, I think that one of the lines I say, I didn't say this in this story, but there's I use this as a joke, but it takes a while for people to laugh. So the parent goes to the teacher, tennis teacher, and says, I'd like my child to learn an all-around tennis game. I'd like him or her to get a college scholarship. And I say, well, if the coach is honest, he'll say, pick one. And because I think the scholarship thing is a real slippery slope of potential toxicity. You're basically professionalizing childhood now. You're basically saying your childhood is now worth $300,000. And therefore, as long as you do things that attain that, we're on the path. So losses, investment, what's the growth mindset? Oh, the growth mindset is we keep winning. That doesn't mean learn to volley. That means do things that help us win. And it goes, that junior life can go pretty quick.
Yeah.
You're not comfortable in the, if you're not, I firmly believe if a player is not comfortable in the front part of a court by the time they're 15, it's always going to be a third language. And they're going to have a broad gap in their skill set.
Interesting.
And so, but I see players who don't learn to do those things, who don't learn to play that. And they never really learn the broadest part of the game. And then the matches become these grinding matches because they have very few skills to draw on. Mm-hmm. And tennis to them then becomes all about grit and fight. It's a game. It's a game. It's a broad game. I mean, for example, I hear there's the Spanish system, which I like a lot because of its work ethic and its ground strokes, talks a lot about suffering. It's a game. It's a game. Yeah, you suffer when you have a bad loss. You're working hard when you're in the second or third hour of a long match, but still not meant to be a suffer. Life will bring you plenty of other suffering. I guarantee you that. And other
That's
people
true.
In other ways than a game.
Well, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that it's a game and that it's supposed to be fun, right? Because it's become such big business. Junior tennis, junior sports across the board have become very big business, at least in our country. And it's very expensive to have a child who purports to want to reach the highest levels of whether it's tennis, it's golf, it's soccer, it's playing violin. Doesn't matter. It's an expensive, long, arduous journey with so many incredible lessons that have nothing to do with the actual subject matter that you're pursuing. And we have to keep that in mind, especially as parents who are supposed to be guiding these children into their development from childhood to adulthood. Now, is it more fun when you win? Sure. You know, feels good to win. It feels good to hold a trophy. It feels good to walk in your living room and see a shelf filled with awards that you've been able to win because you've put hard work in. But just because those things don't exist doesn't mean you haven't learned and grown from the pursuit.
Well, it's supposed to be all about the pursuits. I'm really glad when I wrote a good English paper that people didn't start showing up and saying, wow, 13 years old, wrote a paper, you could write for the New York Times one day. Let's do it. And like I've talked about, this is one of my analogy stories about kids who learn to play tennis in a very narrow way. So the kid wins a 12s or even a 14s tournament and is doing pretty well. And so I wrote a really good paper when I was 13 on Franklin D. Roosevelt. Wow, this guy wrote a really good paper on a president. Keeps writing like that, he'll get a scholarship writing about presidents. And so write another paper about a president. Okay, I'm going to write another paper. I'll write a paper about Harry Truman. And then all I'm doing is writing papers. Wait, I want to write a paper about a scientist. I want to write a paper about Albert Einstein. No, don't do that. You might lose. That might not be as good. Keep writing papers about presidents. By the time hey, you got a scholarship. You get to go to this school because you wrote 17 papers on presidents and that got you a scholarship. And then you think, and by the time I'm 19, the last thing I ever want to do is think about a president. And I think the way kids learn the game is unfortunately way too like that. Way too little emphasis on the broadest set of skills. Way too little emphasis on practice matches. I mean, I want to meet the, I want to, I mean, I became, I never played college tennis. I'm just an okay 4-5 player. When I was 13, 14, I would have played 10 practice sets a week. And I bet you, and how many do kids you talk to play that many?
No, it's a big gap. It is a big gap. And that's been an issue.
Yeah, they go right from the Glee Club to the, and then they're playing tournaments.
Yeah.
I wonder they get, things happen in tournaments that are hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where are the practice sets?
Well, and it's so interesting that you bring that up, Joel, because there's been so much chatter. And we go, Parenting Aces does this thing, right? Where, you know, I'm in my 13th year now. So the stories just keep coming back and coming back and coming back. And sadly, not a lot changes. However, what's interesting is one of the big topics of conversation lately has, again, been cheating in junior tennis and cheating at tournaments. And what are we going to do about it? And, you know, why don't the governing bodies fix this? And yada, yada, yada. And it occurs to me that when I was a kid and we played practice sets all the time and we would play against our friends and we all knew those kids that would hook even in the practice sets, right? They took pride in it. But then you'd come off the court and they'd joke around with you. Oh, you remember when I hooked you at 15:30 and, you know, I was down 4-5 and then I came back and won the set. And it would become kind of this whole thing that the kids just kind of worked out together. And it happened on the practice court. So when it happened on the tournament court, everybody knew it was coming. Everybody knew what to do about it. And it just wasn't as big a deal as it seems to have become now. I don't know if more practice sets are the answer to cheating in junior tennis, but I don't know. See, maybe we just solved a problem.
Well, wait, we went from the cheating in tournaments. I don't know if practice sets solve it. That's a different question. The question of why there's cheating in tournaments. Look, there's also, and I don't have children, and you've had children, and I know childhood is much more programmed than it used to be. There's much more time put into how they're going to spend time. There's more parental involvement. There's more driving back and forth, you know, as opposed to kids just hanging out at parks or even facilities. So that's part of it. There's also a lot of these daytime tennis academies that build themselves, these training centers where the parents pay money each day for the kid to work out with other kids. I'm curious. I should explore those more. I've explored them some. They're in groups, like 8 kids on 2 courts, and they're drilling and they're getting sort of group instruction. Is that what occurs?
I mean, there are all kinds of scenarios out there, but sure, that's one of them.
I wonder when I hear about those, I'm not hearing about personal instruction and I'm not hearing about competition. So I'm not quite sure what skills are actually being built other than to hit some ground strokes back and forth for a while in a rotational way, sort of like if you and I went on vacation to the hotel and went to the 3 p.m. clinic. Yeah. I know there's some forms of instruction and engagement, but the problem of cheating in junior terms, that's a different question, but that gets also to values. You know, I've heard stories about players who the parent, when they see their kid cheating or pouting, they say, okay, you're out of here. I'm defaulting you right now. Does that happen much? No, I think a lot of kids are enabled. And so I was talking to someone once, I said, you're the adult, be the adult. Or I said this to someone else who's talking about the coaching of their kid. And I said, you know, coaches are a dime a dozen. She only has one father. So she needs you to be her father. So you got to figure that one out. And this gets into some very personal matters about families and the DNA among a mother, father, child, other children, family priorities. You know, so it's a little bit like the prime directive. You've got to kind of maintain, let families work out their own thing with them. But I think the real... the workshop, there's a whole other work piece for parents to understand what this really is and what goes on out there. And even in some of the language that's used, you know, I once saw a young lady, she was 10 years old, taking lessons, learning to hit well. They went to a tournament and first tournament, the dad said, oh, she was better than than the players there, but they all beat her. They're all pushers. And I said, all right. And I tried to arrest him. There's this tidal wave of language going on out there. I said, you mean the person who got the ball on the court more? That's who she lost to? Yeah, you're a pusher. And the coaches use these terms. Coach, these are not good terms. You know, George Orwell said, not only can thought corrupt language, but language can corrupt thought. And it goes on at the molecular level. The instructor, who's the instructor, needs to tell the student, that's someone who hit the ball on the court more than you. Don't use that word. There are no pushers. Yeah, you know what? One of my favorite, the Nadal-Uncle Tony relationship is one of the greatest relationships in the history of the sport. Okay, so let's say Rafa was at a tournament and he lost to some guy who played like that when Rafa was 10 years old. Rafa said, yeah, this guy's a pusher, Uncle Tony. What do you think Uncle Tony would have said to him?
He would have lit into him, for sure.
And what else do you think he would have said?
You have to learn how to beat somebody like that if you want to...
Meet your new best friend. You're going to play every day for 2 weeks. And by the way, we're not calling him a pusher. We're calling him Bob. Bob. We're going to show Bob some respect because he's Bob, because he hit the ball over the net more than me today. And we're not going to use these terms. And these little terms, it starts at a very young level. You know, that's what development is. It starts with values, and parents need to learn. And of course, parents, they don't know as much about the game. They're new to it. It's a lot to take in. Look at these hotshot kids. Look how good they are. And everyone talks about how good this kid is. It's an individual sport. You know, at least LeBron James needed four of us to get him the ball. So as great as he was, he had to collaborate. And tennis doesn't work like that often.
Right. Right. It's very true. And it's interesting to think about it that way. And you and I have had this conversation multiple times about, you know, the showing respect to the game, and that what is the role of the parent versus the role of the coach. And I want to kind of loop back to your article on Eva, because one of the things that you say in the article, and you've said it here already today, is that she is driving the bus and that the parents are there supporting, but they also have an older child who's in college. They also both have careers that they work at. So what was it when you were talking with Eva's parents that kind of jumped out at you as maybe this is something that other parents need to learn from?
Well, the mom, Yelena, doesn't even know how to keep score, which she's obviously choosing. That's not a choice. So she's trying. And I think the fact that her parents leave her alone a lot and let her go on these trips. I mean, it helps a little bit that she's become so good and ranked, and she's going on trips to the USTA, to Spain, and to training camps in Florida. So she's really having a lot of the certain goodies, company generating good results. So that's neat. I found that's what I liked about it, that they are letting her do it, that they care about school, they care about homework. So I thought that was pretty good that way, that they know that she's the one saying, okay, it's time for me to get to practice, that she's the one who's driven. And I'll be curious to see how things continue for her as her journey continues.
Well, it's also helpful, as you said, because she's having such success, that there are coaches stepping up and kind of filling those roles, where for kids that aren't at that level, the parents are really having to fill the role of, you know, taking the kids and being at the events with them and all of that. And when you're there week in and week out, and, you know, you're seeing all the stuff that's happening at these tournaments and seeing the things that are going on on the training court, it's difficult to maintain your distance and to not get so involved in what's happening, because you're writing these big checks and you're spending all this time. You know, it's a challenge.
It's good to be involved. I think the question for the parent is to learn how to be appropriately involved and what that means and how to talk about it. I mean, I remember I've talked to a parent about, like, what do you say when the kid comes back after a win and says, I played so bad, what do I do with that? And I thought about what to say. And I thought, well, this is after the match, so the kid's in the car, let's say on the ride home, and saying that, I think the first thing the parents should say, how about you first share with me some respect for the other person who played the match with you today? And show some regard for them before you go on your whining jag. Because when a kid is telling their mother how bad they, or father how bad they played, what do they want to hear?
Oh, no, you played great. You were awesome.
Or whatever. Or yeah. Whatever. They want, the kid is flailing for something. And so I think it's the parent's responsibility at that point to say, well, let's show some respect, first of all. Second of all, you want to indulge yourself in your emotions about being upset. You do that when you're ready to have a thoughtful discussion about what worked in the match and what you'd like to improve. We can have that because we want to treat this as a craft, as a practice. You know, if I came home from, again, let's get back to my FDR paper. God, what a day at the library. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't find any of the research I was looking for. And I couldn't say, let's figure. And then when you're ready to calm down, have a thoughtful talk about this match. However, parent, and this is where the instructor's in job is to learn proper ways to talk about that match, what it really was. And I think there's a huge gap in understanding how tennis matches are played and won. They're mostly because I think that, and by the way, you notice how I keep using the word instructor. One of my jokes, I've been at conferences called coaching conferences, is really? You guys are coaches? When's the last time you watched your student play a match? You can't call it your coach. Your instructor. Instructors are fine. Instructors teach you how to hit the ball properly. And actually, I think they're the lifeblood of the game. John Wooden called himself a teacher. Mm-hmm. His book was They Call Me Coach, but he called himself a teacher. Basketball, teaching you skills, how to play. So as far as the dynamic of a match goes, I think there's a whole piece that I think is a complete wasteland about the ebb and flow of matches. How do we talk about a match? How does the parent and the teacher and the player learn to talk about a match in a thoughtful way that's technical, that's tactical, that's emotional? You know, they talk about the mental game. To me, I think that there's too much emphasis on the mental game on strictly the emotional piece. I think the mental game falls into two pieces. The first is let's call it the emotional or the tranquility piece. Find the right piece. And this is people like Tim Galway. Find the right place. Tim Galway, more recently, Jeff Greenwald, who I love. These are great minds who help us find the right place of tranquility to be. And it addresses our emotional anxieties around competing, which are justifiable, which everybody has, including the very best of the world. Novak Djokovic talked about it on 60 Minutes last month with my colleague, John Wertheim, talked about he's nervous too. And you train yourself to be in the right. But then there's the part that I think is vastly overlooked, which is, okay, now the problem solving. Now that I'm in the right place to play against Bob across the net, what do I do? How do I solve Bob? How do I play points? What is Bob not like? What's Bob's game? Where's the cognitive part? And people call it, like, it's a little bit like Brad Gilbert. And then they say, oh, winning ugly. It's not about winning ugly. It's about competing. It's not ugly or pretty. It's not about playing my game. It's not just, oh, I got to play my game and focus on my side of the net. No, meaningless. It's a relationship game. You got another person there. You got to show some respect for them and the game overall. There's another person who's bringing some of their tools out here. And we got to figure this out. But the only way, we're better to figure it out if we build some skills back home. If we play, if we come to net more, if we learn about spin, if we learn the whole game.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is. I mean, if you go to different junior events, you can definitely tell the kids that are looking at this as a long game and they are looking to get better every day and develop skills that by the time they get to college or whatever the end game is for them, that they do have this well-stocked toolbox to take on court with them versus the kids that are out there to get the ranking points, to have their UTR go up or their WTN go up, right? It's a very different approach to tournaments, to individual matches, to competition in general.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. I think it's neglected. I think it's just, I think a lot of the way you talk to, I mean, again, there's so much, and again, but I think a lot of this is the parents who are thinking, yeah, I want that scholarship, and they want, that's an outcome. Mm-hmm. That's an outcome. How many kids who play junior tennis get scholarships?
Not very many.
Good. Fine.
Yeah.
Whatever. It's that shouldn't be the, it shouldn't be, it's the wrong, it's not, I think it's a strange focus. It's a nice out, if it's a nice thing, if it can happen, but it should be about the development of the person.
Well, but I think what tends to happen in some cases, Joel, is it's a way for coaches to justify what they're charging to teach these kids. You know, yes, you're going to spend the money between the ages of 8 and 18, but then they're going to get a scholarship and college is going to be paid for. And that's not the case for most kids. And even if they get a scholarship, typically it's not paying for everything.
I talked to a mother once. She told me she figured out with some of these academies, if she just saved all that money, that would be enough for college anyway.
Yeah. I mean, like, and sometimes twice over.
Right. So, well, that's the thing. The game, the business, there's the pro game that's the business, but then there's the monetization of instruction.
Yeah.
Of instructors seeing how can I monetize this and create a revenue stream for myself that revolves around that. So, like, and for example, I mean, I've talked to players from a number of decades ago, do you think they were spending 10 hours a week with their instructor on the court? No. Spending one or two, take a lesson. And then again,
but it makes you wonder, how were tennis coaches making a living and supporting families back then?
The instructors, like if you were the head pro, if you were a pro at a club, you know, I read about Dick Leach, the great USC coach.
Yeah.
Died a few months ago and there was a memorial. And I was listening to people talk about him, the things he did. They were entrepreneurial in certain ways. They had they were giving lessons at different times of day. They were doing group lessons at some city center. They were starting tennis camps. They were maybe getting involved in either owning or starting clubs. It was not, no, it was not, it wasn't as lucrative. Plus, remember, before about 1970, there weren't nearly as many people playing tennis.
True.
So the sport was a lot smaller. So it was a much smaller sport. They were hustling. Yeah, it's kind of like it. They weren't having these 5 day a week training camps at clubs.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a different environment. But I mean, so that said, you know, I don't think anyone is begrudging tennis coaches the ability to make a living and support their families. I think everybody's entitled to try to do that, but it's a supply and demand kind of thing, you know.
Well, it's kind of interesting. That's a great question. I mean, that's an interesting thing, and that's for the parent and the child to begin to figure out the mix of what helps you actually improve as a tennis player. And so, right, and I wonder what the proper mix of there's instruction and there's group workouts. But again, I think any child should play at least two or three practice matches a week.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
And even if that means skipping instruction time.
Even if that means, because that learning time is all the time.
Yeah.
Learning time is all the time. Yes. Oh, yeah. You can have room in there for an hour. You could have room in there for an hour or two less than a week, but I think there's nothing. It's like piano practice. There's nothing. You want to learn how to play tennis, you need to play practice sets and not just tiebreakers. The problem is someone's talking about, oh, they sometimes play tiebreakers. Tiebreakers are useful, but in a way, remember when you're playing a tiebreaker, you're treating every point like it's 15-30.
Yeah.
And in a match, not every point is 15-30. A football team needs to learn something other than practice third and six.
Yeah.
Fourth and 10, second and one. Now it's windy. Now it's another quarter. And there's nothing like that. There's no substitute for match play. And the closest you get to it is to practice it and to play practice sets. And not just one. I remember once I was playing a junior once, and after he beat me at the first set, he looked over and he goes, You want to play another? I go, do you? So you could tell if I had said that's enough. Oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah.
It's like, and we need to create environments where people, where children are comfortable playing practice matches. At least two sets, sometimes three.
Yeah. Something. Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting. I remember when my son was in juniors and he was going through this period where in tournaments, he would go out and he'd start really strong and he'd win the first set, like handily. And then things would just go, you know, over the course of the next two sets, which he would end up losing. And the coaches, if they were there, would come and they'd watch the beginning of the match and see that he was fine. And then they would leave and they wouldn't see that turning point, whatever it was. And it used to drive me nuts. I'm like, you can't leave after the first set. He's fine in the first set. Come for the second and third sets. That's what I need you to figure out what's happening. Because I didn't have the knowledge to figure it out. My son didn't have the maturity and knowledge to figure it out on his own. He needed somebody there to see what was going on and come up with a game plan. And if you practice one set, anybody can play well for one set. That's the beauty of our Grand Slams, where they're playing 3 out of 5 sets on the men's side, right? Anybody can come out and have a great first set. It's what do you do in the subsequent four?
Well, it's a match. I mean, it's the whole match. You're right. And in the pros, it's probably like anyone can play about 1.7 really good sets. And the 3 out of 5 has a lot of value to it, but even the 2 out of 3.
Yeah.
How do you do that? And again, in the 7 days leading up to that tournament, how many practice sets would your son have played?
Yeah, none.
Oh, well, there you go.
Right.
I'm in the glee club and now I'm in the recital.
Right.
I'm just singing in the chorus. And of course, and then what happens? You get the nervous system, emotions, parents, coping skills, everything. Yeah. If I haven't served at 4-3 in the second set Tuesday afternoon at home, how am I going to, that's just amazing. I'm seeing plenty of kids are playing tournaments, but they're not playing practice sets. Yeah. I'm completely gobsmacked by that. And I don't mean like one set. I don't mean 3 games. I don't mean point play. I don't mean 11 point games. I don't mean live ball. I mean, or tiebreakers. I mean, matches. First set, and now it's 2-all in the second set, and the other person's doing things. And, you know, I talked to someone recently. They said they played they hit some with their friend and they played a set. I go, oh, did you guys hit for like 10 minutes and play a set? No, we hit for an hour and then played a set. I said, I can only do one of those. I mean, I don't know what's quite going on with this. It's kind of that to me is a bigger problem than cheating.
Interesting.
In a way.
That's a big statement, Joel.
You can't control the other person cheating. You can control what you bring to your tournament play.
Mm-hmm. And to your preparation.
Well, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. It's like, that's right. And so the attitude that precedes the lack of that happening is fascinating to me. Like people thinking, oh, I'm going to drill. I'm going to train. I'm going to hit. I got a ball machine. I got this. I got a coach. I'm going to take some more lessons. Like the club I was a member of in Berkeley, I remember saying to a member, they're talking about a junior program. I said, you want a junior program? Here, it's the club directory. It's your junior program. Here it is. It's right there. Because the kid had not conquered the club. It was far from conquering the club. I said, there's 30 people he could play here.
Yeah.
Do it. Solve the problems. I remember talking about that once with Martina Hingis. That's what she did. That's what Tracy Austin did. And by the way, those players often make their own phone calls or text. Teach them that. That's a life lesson.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's going to segue us into this next little piece, which I want to touch on before we close, which is that when you and I met, you were doing or had just finished doing a profile on Ryan and Christian Harrison, or maybe just Ryan. And Ryan grew up at the club that I grew up playing at in Shreveport, Louisiana, Piermont Oaks Tennis Club. And my dad was one of the people that Ryan played practice matches against from a very young age. And I think finally beat my dad the first time when he was like 10. And, you know, my dad was, of course, frustrated, but also thrilled to be part of Ryan's journey in that way. Ryan recently announced his retirement. He's now 31 or 32. I'm not sure exactly. But tennis has been a part of his life since he came out of the womb, I think. And he has two siblings, both of whom play also. Dad was a very fine tennis player, is now a very fine tennis coach. What drew you to somebody like Ryan all those years ago? What draws you to somebody like Eva now that makes you think, gosh, this is something I really want to dive into and understand better?
Yeah, the story wise, but again, this is a function of ease of access and editorial interest. It's not a scientific process. It's not like it's like, you know, again, the biggest thing that draws a journalist to something is interest, an editor's perceived interest in a topic. How much interest might there be around this person? Because it needs to be an interesting story. It's not just like we did this scientific look. The Harrisons I met when they were working at John Newcomb's camp, John Newcomb's Tennis Academy, where I was attending a fantasy camp. So I met them there and I struck up a rapport with Pat, who was working there, with Pat the father. And they were, Ryan was just making his move. So it was just a convergence of things.
Okay.
That was kind of easy. It wasn't like a talent spot. It wasn't, I mean, it's not like, yeah, that's it. That's Joe Montana. There he is. That's the one. I mean, it's not that. It's just an interesting story. And to me, that's what matters. Someone that's kind of interesting. And also, will they give me some time? Will I have some time? Are they thoughtful? Eva was willing to give me plenty of time. So I spent a good amount of time talking with her, talking with her parents, and kind of immersing in their world for a while and addressing these many questions around her development and progress. So there isn't, I think it revolves a lot around, again, it's kind of a confluence of times. Do I happen to have an editor who's interested? I think the Ryan piece was written for USTA magazine, kind of a short profile. So just time and place. There isn't a science to it.
Yeah. It's so interesting to me because, you know, we are, as you said, we're looking for the new, and we like to get behind that. And we see oftentimes in the media that when a kid like an Eva Jovic comes around, everybody is like, you know, on it, right? You got to watch this kid. She's going to be the next great thing, da, 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 da. And I know, you know, Sandra Harwit, she and I had this conversation. She is another fine tennis journalist. And she and I had this conversation years ago about, you know, I wish the media would just leave these kids alone and let them go on their journey and not, you know, shine this massive spotlight on them and put this pressure. There are some kids that can handle that and, you know, put it in its proper place and continue on with the work. But there are other kids that get really sidetracked by that.
Let's see. But I think, first of all, I remember someone on the tour was talking to me about a pro player. They said, you guys in the press put so much press on her, made her an introvert. I go, really? Which one of my stories are you referring to? And so this is why I wrote the story about Eva that way. The media doesn't have to write that story the way people write it. Yeah, I shined the spotlight on Eva, but I wanted to address her in kind of the dialectic in the process. I was sharing my own thoughts about pondering what she might be, who she is, not what she could be, not to do the story of least resistance, which is like, here's another hot shot. You hear it here first. This one, look out, pay attention one day. And also, the pressure. Why is that pressure? Because if it doesn't happen, you what? I mean, see, this gets to the fairness. For example, let's go back to Ryan Harrison. And Ryan Harrison is young. He's going to be a pro. Always, when they're at that stage, everybody thinks they're going to want to win Wimbledon. That's the goal. That's the vision. It's not a goal. It's a vision. It's a desire. And for 99.9% of people who ever play tennis, it doesn't happen. Does that mean it's a failure? And this gets down to families. This gets down to how you have that conversation with a 12-year-old, win or lose. And it's about values. It's about character. It's about comportment. It's not saying it's meaningless. It's understanding what it means and what it's about and what the tennis journey is. I once upon a time, I thought I wanted to be the first Jewish president. Did I fail? Am I a failure because I didn't? What's success? Define winning. And so I think, yeah, part of me, like when I wrote about the speculators with Eve, I said, yeah, let them play. But I think anybody has a right to write about them. It's what the questions they bring to it are. And I try to bring, I know what my questions are. I've been around this sport long enough to know what my real curiosity. My curiosity is not gonna, like someone asked me, a friend asked me about there's another, a junior I saw recently. And my friend says, oh, is she any good? I go, define good. What do you mean by that? I know what you mean. Is she championship caliber? I said, anybody who tells you that about someone under 16 is a liar. They don't know. Nobody knows. And why do you want to do that? Now you're a speculator. Now it's like you're commoditizing a youngster. You're treating them like a stock. How good can they be? What did you say that about my English paper?
My favorite thing that you've said today is, what if they don't achieve whatever it is? Have they failed? Are they a failure? This is my favorite thing, because we have to reframe this. We have to look at this as, these are our kids that are on this growth pathway, and maybe it's going to lead to Wimbledon. Maybe it's going to lead to the presidency. Maybe it's going to lead to parenthood. Maybe it's going to lead to, I don't know, being a tennis coach one day. None of us knows where it's leading.
The thing I like best about Eve is when I talked to her, she looked me in the eye and she talked. And she didn't hide behind her tennis player. Oh, she's kind of shy. And somewhere along the way, she's learned how to be a human being. How to connect that with her parents, who she is, and everybody in that family would look me in the eye and say hello when I talk to them. And I think that's what it's more important, you know, learning how to shake hands with your opponent.
Yeah.
Learning how to respect the game and the world, because the respect for the game in a way is respect for the world, the respect for this thing we're in together, not this whole me and my game. And again, but this gets us some really molecular things on the part of the parents about how we talk about matches and how we process wins and losses and whatever, winning and learning and losing and learning and all these things that shape us.
Yeah. And commitment, right? I mean, that's at the core of this. And I think you talked about that in the article too, is anytime a child is willing and wants to commit to becoming excellent at something, that's a huge win and a huge life lesson, because now they know how to work hard. Now they know how to problem solve. Now they know how to manage their time. I mean, there are all these things that go into that that make them into great adult humans that are going to contribute to the betterment of the world. And I don't mean to sound so lofty, but I just feel like this is something that's missed somehow along the way.
See, to me, she's already a champion.
Right.
She's already a champion because of her committing to something. And I wrote that at the end of the story. That's the point that matters. Just like, for example, you know, one of my great favorite competitors is Charlie Brown from Peanuts. He loses every time, but he doesn't lose anything because he keeps going back out there. He's an existential hero. And I just think how that's regarded. And I think, look, parents are sometimes replaying through their children some of their own journey through sports and competition and life and, you know, living cathartically through their child, which is potentially toxic. And right. So for someone like Eva, it doesn't matter to me if she doesn't win. She stated that. But that's like, for example, I personally don't believe in goals. I believe in visions. I believe in desires. But I think goals are kind of limited. They turn life into this sort of trade school. You're only focusing on what you can achieve that you know you can achieve. How do you know what you can't achieve? What else might be out there? But I'm a liberal arts person, and I went to school in a day of lower tuition, didn't have as much college debt, you know, et cetera. So I get the need to be practical and focused. But I just think it's can be very toxic. So I think it's important for parents and families to recognize how much champion these kids are. Like, I would want to do a story. I'd like to do a story on someone who loses in the first round of the Nationals. I'd like to do a story on someone who loses in the first round of the Sectionals. I'd like to do a story on someone who loses in a, what is it, level seven, level five.
Yeah.
All of these people can be changed. I mean, someone asked me once, how long does it take to become a tennis player? I said, well, it can take 7 to define yourself as a player. I said, 7 years or 7 seconds?
Yeah.
Participants in your tennis journey and how you define yourself.
I love that. I love that. Well, Joel, it's always a treat to talk with you.
Likewise.
Expand my mind every time we talk, whether it's in person, on the phone, on a podcast. And so appreciate you taking time to share Eva with us, to share her story, and also to share your insights in your, I'm not going to say how many decades in our sport, but lots of decades.
Many decades. All right. Well, thanks. Great talking, Lisa. Thank you.
Thank you. To my audience, thank you so much for tuning in, and we will catch you next time on Parenting Aces.
I'm Lisa Stone, and you've been listening to the Parenting Aces podcast for tennis parents by a tennis parent. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to us and write a review on iTunes. For more information on navigating the junior and college tennis journey, please visit us online at parentingaces.com. Thanks for tuning in and sharing us with your tennis community.